Good morning, please be seated. The next case on our calendar this morning for argument is combined cases 59934, 60483, 61039, 61286. Generally speaking, the part of the case is under a caption, Copper Sands Homeowners Association versus Flamingo 94 Limited Liability Company et al. I won't take everybody's time to read all of the parties in the caption. Welcome to the council this morning and participants in the case. I assume you're ready to proceed for appellant, Mr. Wright?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
All right. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Terry Wright. I'm here on behalf of the Copper Sands Homeowners Association. This case presents a unique set of facts for this court to consider. This is a case where the developers, throughout 1997 through 2004, retained control over a project, and it is a condominium project. In 1994 and 1995, they mapped and swore on this map that, in fact, this was a common interest community created under the laws of Chapter 116. The map was filed, and two companies were involved in construction. That was Plaster Development, three companies, Flamingo 94 and Oxbow. The principals of Oxbow are Dan K. Shaw and Kenneth Woolley. They then formed a company, namely Copper Sands LLC, in 1997. In 1997, they actually transferred the project to this affiliate. Section 9 of the purchase agreement for that sale identifies those affiliates as being involved in original construction. They transferred that property shortly after beginning to rent the units. They rented approximately 248 units, leaving 102 on the rent rolls unidentified as occupied. That, in fact, leads us to Copper Sands LLC retaining control over the project until 2004. Shortly after they obtained control over the project, they actually transferred title to a company called Claremont Sands LLC, which was a debt financier. In 2004, Sean Hyle from Pacifica Enterprises, who is the entity that eventually became the converter and seller of these units, sat down with Richard Plaster personally and negotiated the terms of the sale for this project in 2004. And in fact, that sales agreement that resulted in 2004 contained the name of Copper Sands LLC, and Claremont was its agent. So Claremont was merely holding title for this entity throughout the past 7 years. In addition, Mr. Hyle testified in his deposition that, in fact, Richard Plaster retained marketing rights to the community in 2004. That, in fact, did happen, and they entered into a broker arrangement. Pacifica, prior to entering into that broker arrangement, already had their broker in place, having registered that broker in October of 1993, or October of 2003. So they didn't actually need a broker, but because Plaster Development retained the marketing rights, it was necessary for them to allow Plaster to continue to market and sell these units to the public. That is an interesting situation because, in fact, the fact that they retained control now obviates the statutes of repose that would otherwise apply, and I'm speaking specifically of the statutes of repose in 11.203 and 11.205 of the Nevada Revised Statutes. Those statutes apply to contractors who cease control. Gives them, instead of giving them indefinite liability, it cuts off liability. But once they cease control, those statutes begin to run. As the court expressed in Davenport, the reason that protection is afforded to those contractors is because we want to cut off liability, but we want to give their purchasers also a fair amount of time in which to discover the defects. When in fact the developer retains control of the project, as we saw here, throughout till 2004, Those statutes of repose have already ran, and the homeowners are not afforded an opportunity to, in fact, discover the defective conditions. Therefore, those statutes of repose do not apply. However, we're dealing with condominiums, and Chapter 116 is a comprehensive act, very comprehensive. In fact, it contains its own statute of repose in 116.4116. And that provides a statute of repose of 6 years, regardless of the purchaser's knowledge, similar to what we saw in, or this court expressed in G&H Associates versus Hahn. And in fact, that is repose language which, regardless of purchaser's knowledge, cuts off liability. That's an important distinction because NRS Chapter 116 anticipated declarants retaining control over a period of time. And in fact, under NRS 116.4116, declarants and dealers remain responsible throughout their term until the purchasers purchase the unit. And a purchaser is defined as someone other than a declarant or dealer. So it is a protection for the purchaser, so it doesn't matter. That 6 years does not begin to run until the unit is sold to a purchaser. And that's an important distinction because under 116.3104, subsection 2, transferors of the project are also on the hook for any improvements they've made, basically for the implied warranties under the chapter. So transferors, if you just simply transfer the property, but you didn't build the improvements as we saw Plaster did, from 94, that transfer subjects you to liability under Chapter 116. Likewise, under 4114, dealers and declarants remain responsible. But the last clause of subsection 2 has an important, very important distinction and potentially applicable in this case, if in fact a common interest community was not created by the filing of final maps back in 1994. And it says, the language specifically says, that any person who made improvements before the common interest community was created remains liable for those construction defects. So even if they're not dealers, they're not declarants, or they're not transferors, if you made improvements to the project which becomes a common interest community, you're responsible for the defects. And again, under 4116, and I'm speaking of Chapter 116, under 4116, that only extends to purchasers. It does not extend to anybody else. Okay? That's an important distinction because sometimes the statutes of repose allow other people to bring claims against contractors, such as Chapter 11 may allow another person, an injury, for example, on the premises. That injured person might be able to bring a claim under Chapter 11. They wouldn't be able to do so under Chapter 116 unless they were, in fact, an owner. That's an important distinction. Plaster, in fact, was a declarant. Under NRS 47.240, they admitted under oath that, in fact, the final map was a map for a common interest community. They're bound. That is a conclusive presumption of which they cannot now falsify. And that's according to the statute. The other threshold item for this court to consider is the effect of Chapter 40. As I stated earlier, we had 122 units that remained unoccupied prior to first sale. And under West Park, construction defect is a defect in a residence that is not occupied prior to first sale. But we also had the ANSI decision. And in the ANSI decision, the court didn't necessarily focus on occupancy. They focused on the purchaser's right to bring a cause of action based upon construction defects. And whether or not the occupancy is by a renter or a subsequent purchaser that rents his unit and then sells it again, how does that occupancy establish a construction defect? I would say it doesn't. The important pivotal point here is when the defect was created. And when we look at NRS Chapter 40.615 under the definition of construction defect, we find that it's a defect created during the construction of a new residence. So whenever they built that residence, only those persons involved in construction could have created that defect. Similarly, if you go on and read the next clause of the statute, it talks about or an alteration to an existing residence. Again, at the time the alteration was done, is the time that the defect could be created. In fact, it's absolutely impossible for a renter or a subsequent purchaser who was not involved in the original construction to have created a construction defect. They can only, by definition, be created at the time of construction. Otherwise, they're not construction defect. And an interesting point, I believe it's NRS 40.640, excludes normal wear and tear and deterioration. So, in fact, the chapter already talks about the effect of occupancy, and the effect of occupancy should not be the pivotal point. The pivotal point should be the timing of when the defect occurred. And that would bring harmony among ANSI and all of the provisions of NRS 40.615, 640, and 610 as for claimants. One of the other areas that I would like to touch on is clearly that the Homeowners Association has standing under Chapter 116. They have standing under Chapter 116 under two provisions. One that wasn't argued in West Park, and that's NRS 4117, and that's the right of the association to bring an action against the declarant, even for factors that are not common elements. NRS 116.3102 subsection D requires those matters to affect the common interest community. And that statute, surprisingly, I looked through the previous rulings of the court and the briefs of the other parties, and I don't see 4117 cited. And so it doesn't matter whether or not those are matters that affect the common interest community or not. That's under 3102, but 4117 provides a different relief. But it must be something that is between the HOA. So the HOA is conferred express standing to bring an action against the declarant for breaches of the implied warranties under Chapter 116. One of the final points I would like to make is
Before you move on that point, 4117-2A says a civil action for damages caused by a failure or refusal to comply with any provision of this chapter or the association's documents. Doesn't the language this chapter limit the scope of 4117, particularly common law claims for misrepresentation and fraud?
Correct, Your Honor, but the misrepresentations are also actionable under NRS 4114 when, in fact, they result in building code violations and other actions. I believe 4114 subsection 2 includes misrepresentations in the action. In addition,
would that extend to the HOA, though?
Well, these would be matters that affect the common interest community anyhow. These defects are going to have to be paid for by all the community, not just some of the members. Each member is facing approximately a $25,000 special assessment to repair these defects. And in fact, that's why they brought a claim against the developer for creating these defects in the first place. That is a matter that affects the common interest community. And that would afford the HOA standing under 3102.
But that would limit the claim for common elements, not for individual units.
Correct, Your Honor. We're talking only common elements in this case. In fact, one of the points that I was going to make with respect to the third-party claims was that they didn't vigorously oppose plaintiff's cause of action because, in fact, plaintiffs could never assert a cause of action because Chapter 11 statutes of repose would have barred such claims from the outset. But, in fact, one of the defendants moved, Interstate Plumbing, moved for dismissal of the individual unit claims. And, in fact, that was granted leaving only the common element claims for the time of trial. So, absent that one unique item, all the rest of them were just simply cursory joinders and they rode along the coattails. They incurred costs that were unnecessary from the beginning of the case because plaintiffs could never ever sustain a cause of action against them because they did not retain control over the project. Therefore, the statutes of repose would have barred any claim by the homeowners immediately. And in fact, because the statutes of repose contain that separate provision for indemnity and do not apply to indemnity cause of action, only Plaster and Flamingo 94, had an indemnity claim against the subcontractors. Their costs were completely unnecessary.
Thank you. I reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Reed.
May it please the Court, Rob Robbins for respondents from Mingo 94 and Placer Development. To set the facts a little clearer for your honors, my clients did not retain control. Mingo 94 was the developer of the project originally. Placer was a general contractor, but because he had a limited license, he had to bring in Oxbow to build the project. When the project was finished, it was sold a few months later as an apartment complex. That entity operated as an apartment complex. They sold it a few months later to another entity who operated for the remainder of the 7 years that it was operated as an apartment complex. Then it was sold again to the ultimate converter, which is Copper Sands Realty. There's no relationship between my client, legal relationship between my client and any of those entities. He sold his interest back in 97. He did not retain control. What counsel's holding on to is in 2004 when they were converting the apartments, Richard Placer was asked to be the broker to sell these units after they were converted. He didn't retain a right. Never said he retained a right. None of the purchase agreements talk about retaining any rights. There was no retention of rights. They simply didn't want to use them because they didn't have their own broker. That was in July of 04. I believe it was October of 04 before any of the units even closed escrow. That agreement with Mr. Placer was terminated when they brought in their own in-house broker who was then licensed by that time. Because these things were selling like hotcakes at this point in time. They did not want those commissions going outside their own pockets, apparently. But there's zero retention of control. None. And if you understand that premise, and there are no facts, there are arguments of counsel pulling at, grasping at straws, but there are no facts to support any retention of control. What counsel is advocating here is a complete rejection of the same arguments this court heard in West Park, except that we're about 3 degrees removed from the facts in West Park. You know, we've sold the property 3 times, but during that 7 years, those same 3 entities, unrelated to us, operated as an apartment complex. You cannot, and as stated in the West Park decision by this court, it would be an absurd result to call those units new for purposes of Chapter 40. Therefore, Chapter 40 doesn't apply.
But who are the principals in Flamingo 94?
It's Richard Placer.
And who's the principal in Copper Sands Realty LLC?
It's not Richard Placer. I don't know who it is.
Okay.
But, and again, we can look to the record, and that would be a monumental task, I understand, at this point with all the thousands of pages that have been submitted, but there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. Moving on to Chapter 116. 116 only applies to my client. Now, the HOA may have 116 rights, but they don't have it against my client because there was no common interest community created when my client owned the property in 97. The map did not equate to a declaration, which under 116.2105 requires that the only way you can form a common interest community is to record a declaration. 116.2109 tells you what has to be in that declaration. One of the things is a plat map. Under the section dealing with plat maps, it says the plat map is part of a declaration. It is not a declaration. You can only create a common interest community by filing and recording a proper declaration that has about 14 things. The trial court found that a substantial number of those things are missing. In plaintiff's own brief, he admits that 4 of those things are missing. He says 3 of those items that are required are kind of optional, and the 4th one is mandatory, but it's not important. 116 claims against my client die right there in plaintiff's opening brief. Page 18 and 19, he admits that the requirements for the declaration were not followed. If you don't have a declaration, you don't have a common interest community. Not surprisingly, in 2004, when the converter bought the property, he filed a declaration. It had all the components. He also filed CC&R saying that Copper Sands Realty is the declarant. if you don't follow that declaration properly, you don't get a conduit agreement. Now, he's advanced this argument about NRS, I believe it's 47.242. This is the fact recited in a written agreement between parties are conclusive presumed. This is a general maxim of jurisprudence versus the actual law that the legislature set forth on how to establish a common interest community. You can't simply record a napkin that says Copper Sands is a common interest community, therefore it is. Furthermore, a reading of that statute that he cites, it's not a recital of fact, it's not a written agreement, and there are no parties, multiple. It's a map. It's a plat map. That's all it is, that's all it was, and it has the same names that's put on every other plat map that's filed. And interestingly enough, not interestingly enough, I'm sure justices are aware that any apartment complex, virtually any apartment complex in the last 20 years, this is what you do. You subdivide the property into individual units, even if you're going to do it as an apartment, and it allows you, ultimately, if the project is possibly sold down the road, if the economy gets hot, it gives you more potential buyers. But it does not make it a common interest community simply filing a map. You cannot do it. The legislature told us how to do it in 116.2101 and 2105. Never happened. Therefore, 116 claims don't apply to my client. Period. So you don't have Chapter 40, you don't have 116. So what we have left are claims that ultimately the court found were barred by the statutes of repose. 11202. 11202 is the willful misconduct statute. Ultimately, plaintiff never pled any willful misconduct cause of action. The court asked him to, we asked him to, third-party defendants asked him if he was going to do it. He said no, and said he was going to rely on the general misrepresentation claims that were ultimately dismissed in the final summary judgment motion. With regard to the 10-year statute, the trial court looked at the expert testimony of plaintiff's experts who said that the damage was continuous and ongoing, and injury also occurred in the 10th year. That doesn't qualify under 11203. The injury must first occur in the 10th year. Otherwise, the 6 and 8 year statutes are rendered meaningless. We might as well just have a 12 year statute. So the injury must occur in that 10th year. There was no testimony from the experts. There were a few homeowners that did submit affidavits saying that they had an injury that occurred specifically in the 10th year. However, the court looked at the addendums to their purchase agreements that were given to the homeowners in 2004, 2 years prior to the 10th year, showing that those same exact defects existed at the property. Now, that counsel argues that these are inconsistent opinions because the court later ruled or took the position that it may not be sufficient for a waiver on the 116, which doesn't apply. But it's really not an inconsistent opinion. What they said is, it's sufficient to show the existence of the defect. Whether that's sufficient to equate to waiver under 116, of course, not making that ruling. But it was certainly sufficient to show, and common sense shows, if you have a document in 2004 that says these are the defects, and the homeowners are giving an affidavit saying 2 years later this defect first occurred, they don't add up. So you have the expert testimony that doesn't say anything about an injury first occurring. You have documents clearly showing any of the defects that the homeowners claim occurred in the 10th year actually occurred 2 years prior when they purchased the property. They were given disclosures on that. So the court properly considered the evidence. They didn't ignore the evidence. And we point out in our brief, most of these items were raised for the first time in this appeal or in other motions. They weren't actually made to the actual motion at hand. So we don't doubt they're not improperly considered by the court. But even if the court wishes to consider them, it's still not an abuse of discretion by the court. She made the correct rulings all the way throughout. Counsel for HOA was given every opportunity. This is nearly a 12-year-old case. Other attorneys turned this case down for good reason. You show up on the first day, you know that this is 12 years old. You know it's been an apartment complex for 7 years. You know it's not owned for 6.5 years by the party that built it. You know these things right from the start. You know you're going to be left with, at most, a willful misconduct claim if you can plead one, or if you choose to plead one. If you choose not to plead one, then you don't have a willful misconduct claim. But you're not going to get 116. You're not going to get Chapter 40. And when we first were served with this complaint, we wrote a letter, and we detail this in our responding brief, to counsel, explaining to them West Park, the factors of West Park, the statutes of repose, a brief analysis of those statutes of repose, and told them, your case isn't, you don't have much here. You need to dismiss these claims. No, not going to. So we filed a summary judgment motion in January of, that letter was in October of 08, same month that the complaint was filed. In January of 09, we filed a summary judgment motion on all the issues. It gives counsel a complete roadmap to how we're going to dismantle this case, which those exact reasons were the reasons that the trial courts used to dismiss these claims. This was not a surprise. All known within the first few months. If you didn't know it the day you filed it, you knew it when we wrote you the letter. You knew it when we filed the first time the judgment motion. We did send an offer of judgment nearly a year after the complaint was filed, after all these facts were flushed out. It was rejected. The court went through the analysis on offers of judgment and found that the amount was reasonable. Did not look at the amount plaintiff demand or his expert's demand because that's irrelevant in factoring into whether the amount is reasonable. The timing was reasonable. It was nearly a year after the complaint was filed. And then his rejection of it was, and I think this is the most important part, the rejection of it was grossly, grossly unreasonable. He knew when he filed this thing that it was nearly 12 years old. He knew Chapter 40 was in play, and if he didn't, we wrote him a letter telling him that. For those reasons, the court, as prevailing parties, and because of the offer of judgment, awarded the site fees and costs. She issued several lengthy written rulings on that issue where she carefully goes through each of the costs and the fees and deducts what she thought needed to be deducted. We didn't object and awarded us our fees and costs. And with the issue with regard to duplicative costs and third-party defendants riding our coattails and that they didn't need to go out and get experts, your honors and each of you, because I've appeared in front of each of you, I think on trials, in fact, with CB, you know that when you file a third-party a complaint, there's going to be a third-party complaint. You know they're going to get experts. Those experts don't necessarily agree with the defendants. They're advocating from a position of third-party defendants, not my client, and my client conversely. So there's no line of coattails. In fact, Interstate Plumbing filed its own summary judgment motion on this issue that we didn't file that counsel just spoke about. So there was no writing of the coattails. So do you owners have any other questions? I believe another issue was the peremptory challenge. Originally, this was...
I have a question about that. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions I can answer the court? Otherwise, I'll defer the rest of the time to counsel to respond to the matter.
2 minutes and 12 seconds.
2 minutes and 12 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Eileen Marks. My clients in this case are Interstate Plumbing and Air Conditioning and Rayburn Ronan Landscaping Designers. I'd like to take the remaining 2 minutes and 12 seconds to address the issue of standing that was raised by the appellant this morning and the motion for a partial summary judgment that was filed by Interstate Plumbing and Air Conditioning and the granting of that motion and dismissal of the claims raised by that motion by the trial court. The motion that was filed by Interstate Plumbing and Air Conditioning was an identification of those plumbing and mechanical claims for which the individual unit owners owned the claims as opposed to the association. The basis for that position by Interstate was the definition of a unit within the CC&Rs for this project, as well as the specific assertions made by plaintiff's experts that these were claims that were not asserted to exist throughout the project, but in fact were asserted to exist within individual specified units. And for each of those allegations, the 13 allegations raised in the motion, specific units were identified as to where they exist. In response to the motion, the plaintiff dropped three of the claims and then took the position that they were common area claims only because the repair, as asserted by the plaintiff, was to cut into the drywall. the position taken by the plaintiff at the time of the hearing and in the opposing brief was the issue of the type of drywall being cut or the type of wall being cut, but there was no evidence presented that, in fact, the repair was going to affect either a load-bearing wall or a fire-rated wall. The appellant took the position throughout, including through the briefing for this appeal, that the only claims they chose to assert were those that were common area claims. They did not ask the court to perform a Rule 23 analysis. They did not ask the trial court to allow them to pursue those claims in a representative capacity. Their position was they are common area claims, and as a result of that, the trial court should allow them to proceed. The trial court analyzed the evidence that was presented to it and made the determination that the claims that were specifically addressed in the motion were, in fact, individual unit claims, not common area claims, and given the position taken by the association at the time of the hearing, rendered the ultimate decision that those claims should be dismissed because they were not claims that the association was looking to pursue in a representative capacity. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Very brief, Donna Cherry, welcome on behalf of the HOA again. First of all, the principals for Copper Sands Limited Liability Corporation were Dan Shaw and Kenneth Woolley. To answer the court's question,
is that in the record?
That is in the record, Your Honor.
Where might I find that?
That is going to be in
no great if you need time to look it up. If you just notify the court with a supplemental filing, that would be useful.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It is in Section 9 of the purchase agreement, but I'll notify the court. Second, the point is defendants came up here and they stood up here and they said, Chapter 116 doesn't apply. We're not dealers, declarants, transfers. Well, they are all dealers. But let's remember, under 116.4114, the last clause of that, Section 2, the last clause of that before they get into the subsection says any person who creates an improvement to the property, even before a common interest community was created. That's an important note. And they don't address that because that does purport liability upon Plaster. Willful misconduct, Your Honors, that's an exception. That's not a cause of action. That's an exception to the statute of repose. And the only other thing that I would mention is that withholding 17,000 pages of documents by itself does not make an offer of judgment reasonable in timing and amount. And withholding it for a year and a half prior to trial, that's not reasonable in timing or amount. And therefore, plaintiffs were prejudiced by not having that information to understand the retention of control over this project at the time of the offer of judgment. Thank you.
Chief, if I can ask one brief question. Mm-hmm. You indicated that a plot map was filed and you were, so to speak, extrapolating on that. They responded that more than that had to be filed and you didn't comply. What's your position?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you clarify?
As the plot map and other extensions had got you into a certain situation, they in turn got up and indicated that you had not met all the formalities.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. With respect to the declaration, the plot map, in fact, under 2109, can be a declaration itself if it contains all the essential elements. Three of the elements that the court found that didn't exist were permissive elements, meaning only if the developer reserved rights to make improvements to a property would that need to be mentioned. He did not. He created the community. He, in fact, developed the community, and he completed that. He didn't reserve that right to creating that one time in the future. The only right that was mandatory was whether or not how the units shared in the common interest or in the common areas, the percentage of that. Well, there's 360 units, and by default, they share 1/360th. So that, in fact, was a minor, or you know, it identifies how many units were in there. All these factors were permissive. They're standing up here telling me that they were all mandatory. Only one was mandatory, and that was the 1/360th on how the homeowner share in the common area. And by default, Chapter 116 applies that. In addition, the CCNRs eventually filed in 2004 identified that share as 1/360th. And since Plaster worked with them in brokering the sales, in reserving their marketing rights, they in fact were persons acting in concert to create a common interest community, which under 116.035 makes them declarants.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, counsel, for your briefs and your arguments here today. The case will stand submitted.